We begin today again with Scotland. The Yes side may have fought the more inspiring campaign, but the No side has prevailed. Earlier this morning, the Yes leader and First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, conceded defeat.
On behalf of the Scottish Government, I accept the result and I pledge to work constructively in the interests of Scotland and the rest of the United Kingdom. Secondly, the Unionist parties made vows late in the campaign to devolve more powers to Scotland. Scotland will expect these to be honoured in rapid course.
And then, less than an hour later, the Prime Minister David Cameron promised to deliver on his promises of more devolution.
To those in Scotland sceptical of the constitutional promises that were made, let me say this. We have delivered on devolution under this government, and we will do so again in the next Parliament. The three pro-union parties have made commitments, clear commitments, on further powers for the Scottish Parliament. We will ensure that those commitments are honoured in full.
And that was David Cameron speaking at 10 Downing Street just after 7 o'clock this morning. I'm going to discuss the political ferment in Scotland and what followed this referendum and indeed the future of the United Kingdom with Geoffrey Donaldson, MP, also Kevin McKenna, who's a columnist with The Observer, and Ian McWhirter, political commentator with The Herald and Sunday Herald. First to you, Geoffrey Donaldson. Does it come as some relief to you, first of all, as an MP for a Northern Ireland constituency, that the answer of the people was no?
Oh, undoubtedly that is the case, because I think if Scotland had voted yes, it would have created constitutional turmoil and would have resulted in what I think would have been a very painful dismantling of the United Kingdom in terms of Scotland leaving and a reordering of the Union in terms of Northern Ireland, Wales and England. So whilst there is undoubtedly a major constitutional debate that will be had in the aftermath of this referendum, the consequences are not nearly as severe as would have been the case if Scotland had voted yes.
At the same time, though, there is a ferment. Nothing is going to be the same. We've heard about those promises that probably swung the vote in favour of no in the last few weeks, certainly. And we heard, I think you probably heard Gerry Adams there, that clip of him from Morning Ireland, saying things are going to be different in Northern Ireland as well. The nature of the union is changing.
Well, it may not change in the way that Gerry Adams wants. So, you know, if Gerry Adams thinks he can draw comfort from this, I think he needs to think again. Sinn Féin, I think, are going to have to readjust. There is no prospect of them achieving their goal of taking Northern Ireland out of the United Kingdom. So it really is time for them to get real on that and to join the rest of us in the constitutional debate about how we do things within the United Kingdom. That's what the DUP is calling for. It's why we've asked for the parties to take part in intensive discussions. Those discussions will link into that wider constitutional debate about the Assembly, how it operates, the kind of powers that it should have. I think it's also time for Sinn Féin, once and for all, to end the nonsense of not taking their seats at Westminster. I think that they need to find a way of sitting down with the rest of the parties and engaging in this debate, not just outside the corridors of Westminster, but actually in there as well.
But there has already been a process of intense negotiations, but it wasn't Sinn Féin, it was the people on your own side of it, Geoffrey Donaldson, who refused to go with the formula that was proposed for getting over things like the past and flags and so forth.
Well, and the people of Scotland have refused to go with another formula. There's nothing wrong in that. In fact, it's healthy in a democracy to reject things that you don't think are going to work. What we need to do now is get back around the table and try and reach the consensus that is necessary, both here and across the United Kingdom. And I might also add that I think this too goes beyond the United Kingdom. From our perspective in Northern Ireland, we need to look at our relationship with the Republic of Ireland, how that can be improved. And I don't think unionists have anything to fear from that. And I would like to see the Republic coming closer to a United Kingdom that is changing. I don't mean giving up independence or anything like that. I just mean enhancing the relationship between the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom, including Northern Ireland. So I don't think this debate stops at the border, if I may say so. I think it has implications for Dublin as well.
But might it mean a loosening of the union? Because we've seen now the demand there has been, particularly from England, for English MPs to vote on matters that affect England. And David Cameron has indicated as well earlier today that in line with the process of extending devolution in Scotland, he's going to look at England as well. So effectively, the result of all of this is going to be a weakening of the union.
Well, a decentralised union doesn't lead necessarily to a weaker union. Would you describe Germany as a weak nation because it has structures that are decentralised? I mean, I don't think that necessarily follows that because a nation decentralises power, that the nation becomes weaker. There are many nations in the world today that have decentralised power. And they're certainly not weak. And I think from Dublin's perspective, Germany is a very powerful nation indeed when it comes to your economy. So I don't buy that notion at all. I think that's a myth, and the idea that a decentralised nation is a weaker one.
And would you have any concerns or many concerns that as part of the loosening of those structures and the extending of devolution that, for instance, the block grant that goes to Northern Ireland, from which people in Northern Ireland do rather well on a per capita basis, that somehow could be reduced or affected?
Well, yes, we need to look at all of that, and of course we will argue the best case we can for Northern Ireland, but we are in a new economic situation, and that would be the case regardless of the issue in Scotland. I think even if the debate hadn't come along in Scotland, the austerity measures that have been taken forward mean a rebooting of the UK economy, and that has implications for Northern Ireland. And I want to get to a place where in Northern Ireland we have less dependence on public subvention, a stronger economy, a stronger private sector, and of course retaining strong public services where they are needed, but investing properly in them. So I think that, you know, rather than kind of lurk in the shadows waiting for cuts to our block grant, we really ought to be making Northern Ireland a more successful economy so that we become less dependent upon that grant in any event. Now, that's not an argument for cutting it. I'm saying we will fight to get the best deal for Northern Ireland, but the reality is, just as in the Republic, and in fairness, the Republic is recovering well from the very difficult financial circumstances that it found itself in, we need to do the same in Northern Ireland.
Geoffrey Donaldson, MP for Lagan Valley, DUP MP for Lagan Valley at Westminster. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Turning now to Kevin McKenna, columnist with The Observer, and Ian McWhirter, commentator with The Herald. Ian, we spoke yesterday. You were predicting this outcome, even though you had been persuaded to vote yes. What's your sense, though, of how things are going to progress now, bearing in mind what we heard earlier from Alex Salmond and indeed David Cameron? Hello, Ian.
Important constitutional moment. After 308 years, first time that there has actually been a democratic vote for staying, for Scotland remaining within the United Kingdom. So it is a very important constitutional moment. However, the UK state went through a near-death experience last week because they realised that they were on the verge of losing this referendum. And the UK parties, led by David Cameron, and they had to come in at a very late stage with a very dramatic and comprehensive, or apparently comprehensive, proposal for devolution max, for federalism, for the constitutional third option, which was kept off the ballot paper. And the problem now is that they have to find some way of delivering that, yet all the opposition parties have different positions, and they don't have a lot of time because they have to have a green paper by the end of next month. They have to have a draft bill ready for Parliament by January and have it ready to go before the next general election. And I think that's a pretty tall order.
Kevin McKenna, you again, like Ian, I think you voted yes while retaining a strong sense of Britishness. Again, would you be concerned that the Prime Minister's insistence now, presumably looking ahead to the general election in Britain next year or in the early summer, is insisting now that the people of Wales must be brought into this as well as the people of England, that somehow that could slow progress or mean slower progress on further devolution for Scotland?
Yes, I agree with that. I think also you have to factor in the pressure that Alex Salmond and the Scottish Government will be exerting on Westminster. Because, let's face it, 1.6 million people in Scotland voted for outright independence. Among them was a significant number of Labour, Scottish Labour voters who recorded a yes vote or who wanted a yes vote, won in protest to what they saw as the failure of the Labour Party at Westminster to oppose austerity measures properly. And secondly, because they felt here was an opportunity to reach out to vulnerable people in our society. And therein lies the problem for David Cameron, because if this is a very short timescale, as Ian McWhirter pointed out. If the SNP government doesn't feel that the devolved arrangements, the new devolved arrangements, are delivered properly or go any way to matching their own expectations, then they will most probably win or use an enhanced majority at Holyrood the following year, and certain sections of their party will go for a referendum all over again. And I'm not entirely certain that the Conservatives, given that many of them are facing steep, intense challenges from UKIP in their marginal constituencies, know themselves the extent to what the new devolved powers might look like. So Cameron's got two fights coming up, and the outcomes are certainly not, they're far from certain.
And coming back to you, Ian McWhirter, I see Philip Stevens in today's Financial Times saying that it's hard not to see this as a celebration of democracy, with some 97% of eligible Scots registering to vote. An astonishing turnout in the mid-80s, in some places approaching 90%. And clearly there's been a huge energy added into the democratic process in Scotland. Is it possible that this matter can be now regarded as settled for a generation or longer, or as Kevin is suggesting they might want to revisit it much sooner?
Well, obviously that depends very much on what happens the next few weeks and months, and whether or not the UK parties are able to come up, as Kevin rightly says, in association with the Scottish Government, because it's going to be a key player in all this. There has to be some kind of consensus reached on exactly what economic powers are going to be devolved to Scotland, the extent to which the Barnett formula, this infamous way of calculating public spending in Scotland, whether that's going to endure, because one of the side commitments which was entered into last week was that the Barnett formula would be retained, and that's going to cause a great deal of unease and anxiety amongst Tories south of the border, who think that Scotland in some way gets further bedded as a result of that Barnett formula. But, you know, I mean, who can say? I mean, obviously, they're going to have to try and come up with something concrete and something pretty substantial. But if they do, I suspect that, you know, that this will endure, at least for a generation, because Alex Salmond has given his own personal commitment that there would not be another referendum. Now, obviously, he doesn't bind his successors or other people in Scottish politics. But I think people in Scotland who the silent majority, hateful phrase that, but the people who came in and decided they weren't part of this great, vivid, colourful, artistic independence movement, but, you know, they came in and they voted just as decisively, as you rightly say, in huge numbers. I don't think they would take very kindly to finding that there's another referendum appearing on the horizon. I think that would damage the SNP electorally in Holyrood. Remember, this is only partly about the constitution. It's also partly about politicians preserving their own jobs, keeping their seats, maintaining power in the Scottish Parliament. And at the moment, the SNP is well positioned, as Kevin says, well positioned to come back to power, at least as the largest party in 2016.
Yes, and on that point, finally, Kevin, you alluded to how some people would have voted yes in order to express their contempt or their objections to how the British Labour Party has not stood up to austerity at Westminster. So is there a possibility now that the Labour Party is going to take something of a drubbing at the general election next year, maybe not as severe as that which the Tories have endured? They're now left, I think, is with one MP north of the border, but that you could see a further erosion of Labour support?
Yeah, there are two problems for Labour here, one on either side of the border. Ed Miliband, if he is to sweep to power next year, will probably rely on Labour, Scottish Labour contingent. And he must hope that, if you like, Scottish Labour voters who voted yes continue to stand by them and don't, as a protest, decide to vote in numbers for the SNP at Westminster. That's one issue. The second issue is Holyrood the following year and the fate of the Scottish Labour Party. Because in 7 years, we have seen them ousted as the natural party of government in Scotland. What has happened is that the SNP, first of all, got into government for the first time and then astonishingly had a landslide victory which led to the majority, which led to them calling for the referendum in the first place. Now, there are many Labour voters who feel betrayed by Labour's behaviour in the referendum campaign with them sharing platforms with the Conservatives. And if the SNP is, for the second time in succession, swept to a majority on a landslide, then you really have to ask questions about the future of the Labour Party in Scotland for the next two generations. 7 or 8 years ago, that would have been unthinkable.
Kevin, thank you very much indeed for that analysis. Kevin McKenna, columnist with The Observer, and also Ian McWhirter, commentator with The Herald and Sunday Herald in Glasgow. Some of your comments: Alan in Limerick says, feeling sad this morning for Scotland, fear of change, inflamed by scaremongering and bullying, won the day over political and social justice and a new vision for the future. After 12 years living in Scotland, I'm sad that many will not live to see this vision become a reality. Ed says, pity we haven't set a better example for the Scots. The endless fiasco that is Ireland was frequently referred to in debate. No wonder they voted no. Pat in Glasnevin wonders, in the light of the Scottish referendum turnout, should there be a minimum turnout level below which an election poll should be classed as invalid? Well, what do you do if you don't get enough people turning out? The question arises, I suppose. Interesting point. We may discuss it with our gathering later on in the programme, where we'll be returning to the Scottish outcome. The question of giving the vote to people aged just 16, those between 16 and 18, we're going to have a referendum on it in this country next year. But after the break, we'll be talking about drugs in inner city Dublin.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.